We're excited to change the world of startups for the better, but trying to make a difference and turning our good intentions into reality has proven to be more complicated than expected. We constantly encounter unexpected second-order effects. When we solve one issue, we end up unintentionally creating another one. It's dawning on you that being a good leader is more complex than simply having that one big idea. True leadership is about the difficult decisions and trade-offs you encounter whilst executing it. On this show, we explore the entrepreneurial zeitgeist with the aim to work and lead differently. Between all of us, we can decode what it will take to be a leader today. We all read the same business books and watch the same TED Talks. However, our visions for success are radically different. Do you really know what you're optimizing for when growing your company? Growth, headcount, revenue, profit, freedom, impact, or even creativity? In this episode, we talk about why great advice for one leader, one vision, and one company might be the wrong advice for another one. You will learn about the four stages of your entrepreneurial journey. And we will decode why certain ideas work for certain stages and not for other ones. In this episode, I'm speaking with Jodi Cook. She built and sold her social media agency over a 10-year period and writes books and articles about entrepreneurship. Fun fact, she also competes internationally in powerlifting. Let's dive in.
I started my own business in 2011 when I was 22, and then I built it and ended up selling it at the age of 32 in 2021, hence 10-year career, which is the title of my new book that's just come out. So during that time, I don't think I knew that this was the process looking forward, but when I look back, I can see that it went through four distinct stages, each of which came with their own characteristics, pitfalls, the right things to do, the wrong things to do. And in figuring that out and making, of course, a bunch of mistakes along the way, I think I came up with quite a useful framework that can help other entrepreneurs do what I did, which is start, grow, sell, and then make work a choice and be ready to move on to whatever you want to do next.
Yeah, I love that. And obviously that resonates with me on so many levels, one of which is that I am in year four of my agency. And so obviously I'm seeing myself on the 10-year career path that you have been on, and watched your talks before about how to build an agency. I think one of the things that stood out to me is really is this idea of not every advice with a good intention is necessarily good advice at the right time. Why do you think that is? And what's your framework for that?
I'm so pleased that you're asking about this. And I'm so pleased we're talking about this because it's like the crux of what I feel can really hold entrepreneurs back. So I think there's the element of it that's the wrong advice for each stage of your career and your business. But actually, even before that, I think there's this whole internal narrative that entrepreneurs often don't get right. And I don't think I had this ascertained at the start, but that's what are you optimizing for? So it's like, is your goal to build a big company, or is your goal just to build a profitable company? Do you want to maximize headcount? Like, is your version of success employing as many people as possible? Or is it actually, I want to employ as few people as possible and just maximize revenue per person? And then you've got some business owners, all they care about is maximizing their free time because they want to go kite surfing in the afternoons. And their version of success is a company that doesn't need their input. Whereas some others, they might see their business as their creation and their art, and they want to just spend as much time as possible creating. And then you've got, if you want to build a $1 billion revenue company, or maybe you just want to pay yourself a 7-figure salary and that's it, and you don't care. So there's all these different reasons to start a business. And yet we're probably all reading the same business books. We're all watching the same TED Talks, and it can take quite a lot of self-awareness and probably courage to say, this is what I want and this is how I'm organizing my business to match that goal. And I don't think I figured this out for ages until I realized that I wanted to travel. And then what I realized is I'd set up a business that I actually couldn't get away from. And so it went completely against my goal of being able to travel, even though it was growing and I was employing people and it looked great. It was like, well, yeah, it's not really working for me. So you can look really successful from the outside, but ultimately you could not be achieving your version of success if it's just different.
I agree with that. I mean, you ran an agency. I'm running an agency. And I think there's always a position that we need to find for ourselves, because obviously if we want to scale in revenue, if we want a bigger company, yes, we can increase our prices and we can be more effective, et cetera. But ultimately it often comes down to, you know, if you want the company to grow, you need more people. And then that comes with a set of decisions around hiring and training and people management, et cetera. And so I think, especially in the agency world, I find that decision, you know, what is my goal? Is a big company what I'm looking for? I find that so, so crucial. And for me, I've always liked to focus on this, like, what can we make happen with a small team, right? And how does that work? It was not necessarily my goal to set out and run a 100-person agency, but other people do. And they get there in like surprisingly fast time, but obviously they're applying a very different approach than I would be applying with my goal and mindset.
Yeah. And no success is any bigger or smaller than another. It's just how you as the company owner define it. But maybe if we're comparing ourselves to other people, and I think when I was running a whatever number of people agency and looking at ones that were like 10 times bigger or 10 times smaller, you might automatically think that they're 10 times better. But if you get the lifestyle that you want at the same time, or if you get the monthly, I don't know, cash that you want or whatever you're optimizing for, then actually yours is perfectly suited to you, which is perfect.
Yeah. How do you think about that, transmuting that vision to your team? Because obviously, you know, if you want to stay small, but, you know, your manager wants to go big, or if you're going to go big, but your right hand wants to stay small, or did you speak with your team about this, the vision for the type of company that you want to be building? And did people buy into that? Or how did that process look like?
I think it can be really tough. It depends on how selfless versus selfish your goals are. And I don't really mean selfish as a bad thing, because I think you can have a business because you want it to facilitate your lifestyle. And I think there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. But the message that you have with your team is going to be very different. And weirdly, actually, there's probably quite a lot more for your team in that way of setting up, because if you're honest with them and you're saying, look, I know I've got this company, but actually I want to do all this other stuff and I want to travel. Here's what I want you to do. And here's how I'm going to reward you. And I want you to take over running the whole thing. And you're not going to be limited at all. That's quite a good thing to be able to say. But I feel like what really happens is that an owner who does want to be away running a lifestyle business doesn't have that conversation. So they're just absent. And then their team's like, well, hang on, I thought we were building this team together. And then they're just not there. So it doesn't work out. So maybe just honesty is the way of doing it. And if your goal is to build this huge, impressive, life-changing, world-changing company, then get your team on board with that at the same time and make sure they know how they fit in with it.
Yeah, that rings true to me. And I think I have a lot of team members also that, you know, love hiking, love skiing, and that have other things going for them. And I think in many ways, that's also something that unites us, that we all have that idea. We want to work hard and we want to be creative and we want to find solutions. And we all kind of have at least like one other thing, you know, family that we're looking after, et cetera. And so I feel we're kind of on the same page around this. And I think if like four people move in that want to do the, you know, 60-hour week, would probably be a shock to me and the rest of the team as
yeah,
well.
So, 'cause it kind of becomes your culture. I guess you know what you want. You find other people that want similar things. And then you just become a company who acts in a certain way and then everyone's aligned on it. But it could work if you had someone in your company who did want to do 60-hour weeks and that was just their thing.
I don't think I would hold them back as long as they don't expect the same from me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. It's like it's like everyone knowing everyone else's expectations and getting that right before someone joins. And also, I wonder if in the interview process, it's quite a attractive thing, or maybe a candidate would think they are expected to say that they want to work all the time and they want to be there until they're 100 and all these things that they feel like they could say. But if you as the owner know that that's not the type of business you're building, then you probably signpost that in the recruitment process, and then they'd have the confidence to be able to say, well, actually, I am really interested in hiking or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I agree with that. Tell us about the four stages in the evolution of a business, because I feel that will inform a lot of these decisions. And I also feel like the vision might be changing along the way slightly.
Yeah. So the 10-year career framework has four steps: execute, systemize, scrutinize, and exit. And each stage comes with different characteristics, different pitfalls, and also a plan to achieve the completion of that stage and then move to the next. I think as entrepreneurs, we will have progression plans for our team, but I feel like this is the progression plan for us. This is what stops us having the same year 10 times. And really early on in my business, I started going to a networking event with some really wonderful people, but a lot of them had the same year over and over and over again and were just fine with it. And I remember thinking, this isn't me. I want to be progressing. I don't just want to be winning the same types of work and then delivering it and then on this kind of hamster wheel of my own creation. So execute is the first stage. And I think it's probably the most exciting because this is where you're starting out, you're busy, you're saying yes to everything. You're not really thinking about analyzing it at this stage. You're just doing things that don't scale and proving that your business, there's a demand for it. So the plan in the execute phase is that you have your flagship product or service that you know there's demand for, that you're proud of, that stands up to questioning and works. You've got your one customer avatar, and it's one. It's not like, oh, we look after all these different companies. It's like, no, what's the one person or the one type of company or the one type of consumer that you want? And if you only had to pick one, if someone held a gun to your head and said, pick one, this is the one that you say.
I feel like it might be like a stage zero before that, where you really say yes to everyone and anyone. And then you're like, this is causing me a lot of problems. I should start streamlining this.
I think that you could definitely figure out your customer avatar the hard way. I think, well, that's why the execution phase could take someone 10 minutes. It could take people 8 years of their 10-year career just figuring that out. And then the third thing is how you reach them, the one channel through which you reach them. And so for me, it was social media management to marketing managers of SMEs found through networking. And it was like, that was as simple. And then once you've done that, you're into systemize. And this is where you take this thing that you've got that you know is growing, that you know works, and you remove yourself as the bottleneck to growing it further. Because in the execute phase, you probably are the bottleneck. And I definitely was. I was running the Jodie show.
This is the Viola show. I know that problem.
Yeah. And I think agency owners especially, but probably lots of business owners in general, it's like you just do everything and you kind of run around with this false sense of believing that you have to do everything and believing that you haven't got the right people trained. And maybe you don't yet, but that's because you haven't been through to systemizing it yet, because that comes next. So this is pretty much where you take every process that happens in your business and turn it into a well-oiled machine where there are processes, there are SOPs, there are manuals, there are ways of doing things. And every single thing that you automate, delegate, eliminate frees up more of your time to be able to work on the business and not just in the business. And then for me, I started off delegating the account management communications because I had account managers doing the work, but I was doing all the communication. And then it was the training sessions and then it was the sales. And it was like, start with the hardest, but the biggest impact, and then keep moving on until you pretty much do yourself out of a role. And that's success, because you're not needed anymore. And then you figure out, what is it that only I can do? And then do that. And actually, there might be nothing. It might be that you're not needed at all. And then you can move and decide what you want to do after that, which is the scrutinize phase.
What is the scrutinize phase? Do you see that as a phase where I'm assessing about wanting to be in this specific business? Or is that the phase where I'm like reviewing again? Okay, now it's set up, now it's a machine. You know, where's the overhead? What is not working? What exactly am I scrutinizing?
Yeah, it could be any of those things. It's a checkpoint. It's where if you've sorted out, execute, and systemize in the right way, you do truly own this well-oiled machine that is a dream to own, where the magnitude of the fires that you are called upon to put out is increasing because smaller problems are just dealt with The team know how to do it. There's a manual for it. There's a process for it. They follow it. And you are only deployed when it really is something that they can't work out how to deal with. And coronavirus was a really good example of this for me. It was like, yeah, everyone's got a plan until the whole world shuts down. But in an ideal world, they're the ones that you are called upon to put out, and everything else, you're kind of not needed. So once you get there, there are just so many options for what you do. So you could hang out there for a while. You could travel the world. You could have your company looked after by your team and you could not need to do anything at all. You could decide to ramp it all up a new level and go and turn into that 200, 500,000 person agency if you wanted to, and head back into execute to do so. The person who bought my agency had also got to scrutinize and decided that he loved running agencies and he wanted to buy a bunch more of them and to bolt them all together and to run this super agency. So that's what he did after that. And then what I did was think, now is the time to sell, and then moved on to exit. But yeah, you kind of have to do those three first stages in order, because that's what creates you a sale-ready company. If you try and exit too soon, then you'll have to do a huge earnout where you have to go with the company and you have to work for it, basically. Or you won't get the price you want because it's not actually profitable enough, or it's not a good enough entity that a buyer can't wait to buy it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so I think this also explains some of the problems, right, with business books and business advice and all the TED Talks, because what is right for an execute company might not be right for a scrutinized company and the other way around. And so I'm curious, do you have examples for things that make sense in one phase and then all of a sudden don't make sense anymore in another phase? And this is where the advice starts to fall short?
Yes, absolutely. I think one of them is around how involved you should be. Because I believe the execute stage is where you should be super involved, crazily involved, and not even thinking about delegating, automating, doing anything else other than just learning the stuff yourself and doing all the stuff that doesn't scale. Whereas if you say you had systemized your business and then you start thinking about it, if you're too involved then, you're undermining all your team. It comes across as micromanaging, and it probably is micromanaging because they're trained, they can be left to it, you can trust them. But I guess some leaders can't really help but get back involved. And I think it often really is to the detriment of all the hard work they've put in. I think most of the pitfalls come from doing something too soon or too late. So maybe thinking about exit before you've systemized your business, or maybe thinking about systemizing before you've executed. Because if you do that, you end up just systemizing stuff that probably doesn't really actually add anything to your business. And you end up writing software and creating programs and automating emails that aren't even effective.
Right. Yeah, I think we've been trying to create a bit of like a framework internally around when do we create a process around something. And where we've landed at a little bit now is, you know, when it lands on your table for the first time, just do it. Because, you know, maybe it lands there once, you know, and it just only needs to get done that one time. Or it's so complicated, there's so many moving parts to figure out in the first time. And so the first time is kind of like get the job done. And then I think the second or third time is then when we start creating a process around it. And then basically when it comes more often, teaching other people to do the same thing, essentially. But, you know, if it's the first time, execute, don't over-engineer it. And then when it's a repeated thing is when we try to systematize. Do you have a similar philosophy, or do you have any feedback for that?
I love that. I love that you've almost got the mini 10-year career framework for individual tasks. But yeah, it makes perfect sense, because you want to see if it's going to hit your desk again. I think it's really useful to be able to recognize patterns, so that if you had, say, an inquiry that came in, and someone in your team says, this needs to be taken case by case, this is a unique inquiry, it's really good to be able to understand, is this a new inquiry? Is this completely unique? Or does it follow a pattern that we already have a blueprint for? Because it's really easy to want to think that everything needs this fresh, new, super customized approach when it might just not.
I love the idea of the two different customer avatars and how you're working with that. And I think that is a crucial point. Are you usually the one who's creating these frameworks and mindsets and you are driving that, or does that come from your team as well?
I think that I started doing it and then I found that my team started doing it too because they realized how useful it all was. So that was great. It became a game changer because I found the more we could take case by case out of it and the more that I could help them see that hardly anything is case by case, the more they could be resourceful, find the answer, and the less they would need me.
What kind of experience level were the people that you've hired? Because that, I think, is also one of these business decisions or business advice that can have very, very different outcomes. And I think, especially in the internet entrepreneur scene, often the advice is hire a virtual assistant first. They're kind of cheap, you know, write them a good SOP and then they can do things for you. And there's obviously something to be said about being able to learn delegating with them, letting go of a few things. I personally, interestingly, have taken pretty much almost the opposite approach, which is like since the beginning, I've always hired people who already had experience, who already knew what they're doing, who were very independent, who very much could do their own thing, which obviously leads to another set of second order effects, because then everyone is doing their own thing and it's not necessarily streamlined and I might not have written an SOP, et cetera. And so, you know, there's another set of consequences, but I'm wondering how you think about that. And again, does that have something to do with the stage maybe, or is that one of these questions around what was the vision or goal from the get-go for a company?
I don't think I had a proper vision or goal in mind at the start. I don't think I even realized that that hiring a VA or a personal assistant was a possibility. I just thought I need to clone myself. And therefore, I found people who were social media managers, or they wanted to be social media managers. So I think my first 5 or 6 hires were people who were fresh out of university or they were fresh out of college and they were good at writing. They knew they wanted to be in a social media role, but they didn't know exactly what they wanted to do. And they were just great people. They came across as conscientious. I could see that they could be in front of clients and do a really good job. And they had good written skills. And then I figured I could just teach them the rest, because this was 2011. Social media was only really invented like not that many years before then. So I didn't really care that someone had loads of experience, because it wasn't possible for them to have loads of experience. It was just, well, if you're a nice person and you can write stuff, then I can teach you the rest.
At what stage in your company did you start putting like a layer of leadership or management?
I probably put layers of leadership into my company far too late. Because the first 5 or 6 people I hired were social media managers, it was like I was managing every single one of them. And I was also speaking to clients. So there was kind of 2 tiers and it was just me and everyone reported to me. So when I started putting tiers in place was when I started creating teams of account managers, and then we had team leaders, and that was great. But I think overall, even towards the end, I quite liked the idea of having a fairly flat organization. And I think that comes from wanting to hire people who were more partners than like employees, and wanting to hire people who were resourceful and who were very proud of figuring things out themselves. So I guess I saw it as, if I can just have people where you could never tell who was the boss and who was the junior, then that's really good, because it means everyone's doing their stuff really well and doing their stuff really well for clients, because it's just in their nature to do so. So that was my ethos, and it's going to go wrong sometimes, but I quite liked when it went right. It worked out really well.
Yeah, I love that. I share that vision very much. What I hear you say is also that sounds a lot like what people sometimes call like radical responsibility or ownership. And so I'm curious, how would you describe your leadership style? Was like participation and empowerment always something that you're interested in? Or is that also something that you found out on your journey?
Well, I'm so happy you asked this, because it got me thinking about where it came from. And I think that I was raised to be very independent from childhood. Like it was in my family, it was seen as being a really good thing to figure something out for yourself. Even so far as from when I was like 4 or something like that, I had to book my own dentist appointments and doctor's appointments. And if we ever went on holiday, it was up to me to pack my own suitcase. So it was never an option that someone else might do something for me. It was always, well, if you can do it, you know where the phone is, you can speak, therefore you need to make your appointment. And I only realized when I went to university that it was not normal that I paid my own phone bill, booked my own appointments and did all this stuff. I might like bought my own car, because most people rely on their parents to do stuff for them until they're very old. So maybe it's something like having that instilled in me from a young age, which then meant that I saw that as a really attractive quality in a team member. So then I hired people who were more resourceful, and then it meant that they needed babysitting a lot less. Like, I never wanted to have to babysit people. I saw it as a really bad thing if someone just kind of said, oh no, I can't work it out, and then just left. I'd be like, what? This is your career. This is your career. These are your clients. This is your work. Like, what do you mean you're going to just leave it? So I guess those people didn't really last very long. And I gravitated towards people who could do their own thing. Something I remember from interviews is that I looked for answers of people running projects or doing something which showed that they owned things. So, you know, like if you ask someone what hobbies they've got, and then they say like hiking, because we've mentioned that. And then you're like, oh, how often do you do that? And then someone who takes ownership of stuff and makes things happen will tell you the last time they went hiking. They'll tell you a bit more about it. They'll make it really clear that it's part of their lives. But someone who isn't really like that, they'll go, oh, well, I don't really have time because, you know, this is happening and that's happening. And, well, I haven't been for ages. Or they'll just have some kind of excuse. And I don't want the people who've got the excuses. I want the people who just figure out what they want and just make it happen. And I think they made the best team members and partners in my company.
Yeah, that would have been my next question, how you look for that during hiring and training. And I think that was a really good answer. Do you ever felt like there's any downside to having people being very independent and self-sufficient in terms of like culture and connection or collaboration? And I'm asking that because that's the space that I'm navigating. Like I said, I think a lot of people in my team as well are very independent, understand how to find their own solutions. At the same time, like now is the year we're trying to grow together and collaborate more. And so we're currently reinventing the way we're working. And so, yeah, just curious how you think about that.
I think the main danger is the too many cooks thing. And because my last name's Cook, it kind of made sense. It's like, there are too many cooks, as in there are too many people trying to make the decision because everyone believes that their way is right. And I think overall, that's a very good problem to have. I would rather have everyone with a strong opinion than no one with a strong opinion, just going on following, ticking boxes blindly. But then it comes down to who is in charge of what, who has like the ultimate responsibility over that thing. And in my agency's team, we had Joanna, who was head of client services, whose job description was keep clients happy, keep the team happy. And that covers quite a lot of what goes on in an agency. So I remember trying really hard to make sure that if I had a strong opinion on something that actually didn't affect my work, it affected Joanna's work and the work of the team that she was running, I let her have the decision. And so sometimes I felt like Joanna was in charge of me because I was so careful to try and not undermine her. So I guess it involves stepping past any ego or any preconceptions that you've got about you having to be the boss. Because if you want to build a flatter team that doesn't rely on you, then someone else has got to be in charge. So just make sure it's someone who you believe in.
Yeah. What does it mean for you being a boss or being a leader?
So I don't know if I had an answer to this until COVID, because in March 2020, we lost about 25% of our entire client base because we had clients in hospitality, travel, events. And that was probably when my leadership skills were the most tested. And what I found that I did was I tried to take on all the fear myself, because I just had this idea that no one really does their best work when they're scared. No one knows what's going on. The news was crazy. It was like all sorts was happening. Everyone's hearing all these horror stories. People are getting laid off, et cetera, et cetera. And I just thought, I can take all the fear away from my team so that work can be something that they look forward to doing rather than being part of the fear. And then I found that I didn't hide it as well as I thought I was hiding it, because they all kind of got it, but they all appreciated it at the same time. So we ended up all really pulling together that summer and growing back to normal, and then growing by another 20% just because we all got on the same page, did what was needed, went over and above to make sure that we worked on replacing our clients. So maybe it's not necessarily taking all the fear, but maybe it's being prepared to and trying to put your team's mindset first, really. I feel like the leaders that I look up to and I think do a really good job are those who can keep perspective at all times and can just focus on the truths of what's happening rather than get swept away in the media and the fear and the kind of franticness that was going on.
Yeah, I recorded a podcast recently with a friend of mine, Gareth, who ran and exited a performance marketing agency. And he talked a lot about the inner game of entrepreneurship and the mindset with which you come and how much you're bringing, you know, your personalities, your fears and your things to work, and then consciously deciding, like, is that really what I want to be bringing? And I do think in many ways, the business of running a business is much more psychological, at least after a certain size, I think, than at least I was aware it would be when I started out.
Yeah, I don't think you realize it first. You just think, I'll get clients, I'll do the work, I'll send invoices, and you don't realize that it's a whole different minefield, especially when you start hiring.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. Tell us a little bit about the fourth stage of the 10-year career around the exit, and then also what happens after the 10 years of career.
Well, so exit, it takes a few different forms. So exit doesn't have to mean that you sell. Exit could mean that you extract yourself from the business fully and other people run it. But I think that is really tough to do. I think people do, they do it. They can get themselves where they own their business but don't run it. But you have to be very clear that you cannot get tapped on the shoulder by anyone who might need you. So for me, it was to actually sell and to hand over and to not be involved at all. But I think some people might be able to do the second way round. And then this stage pretty much involves being intentional, making the plan and just making it happen. And it's a very small percentage of business owners that get here. I've got a quiz to help people work out which stage they're in. And it's at quiz.10yearcareer.com. But from the results of all the hundreds of entrepreneurs who've taken that quiz, 63% are in execute, 33% are in systemize, 3% are in scrutinize, and only 1% are in exit. And that's not even people who have exited, that's people who are ready to exit. So it's hardly any business owners are there. But the exit phase and completing it successfully means not extending it longer than it needs to be extended, because you can be vaguely selling your business for years and years, speaking to one buyer at a time with the power all in their hands because there's no competition. Or you can do your research, you can find your broker if you're going to use one, and you can go out to everyone at the same time, and you can have a business on a deal on your terms because your business is actually a dream to run and own. That's the way to do it. And one pitfall that I've just thought of about exit is just doing it too slowly, but also telling people before they need to know. It's like the exit stage should be like the shortest, fastest. It's like ripping off a band-aid. It's like it just needs to happen and it just needs to be done. And then you can decide what's next. But that's kind of the beauty. You can do whatever you want. If you've got your business to the stage where it's a saleable entity that someone takes off your hands, that you don't need an earn out to hand it over, then it opens up a world of possibility. And you probably know by now, because you probably haven't been too involved day to day anyway. So if you do want to do your sport all day, or if you want to start another business, or if you just want to do nothing, then all is completely fine. But you can begin your next phase safe in the knowledge that you're ready for it.
Yeah. I have a feeling that a lot of people who successfully go through this process will have eventually a new thing lined up, not necessarily a business, could be an organization, like you said, could be a sport, a book, art, et cetera. But I have a feeling that the people who have the drive and empathy and talent, you know, to make it successfully through it might start another 10-year career after that in whatever way, shape or form, you know, that might come. Is there anything that you would have wanted to talk about that we didn't get to talk about yet, or anything that you feel is like important to close out this conversation?
I think overall, entrepreneurship is such a massive paradox. It's like we want to work really hard, but we want to work really hard on our own terms. We want all the freedom, but we also want something that needs us in that we've got the skills to make it a success. We want to be busy doing what we love, but not so busy that we feel like we're frantic. We want to do things kind of in the proven way, but we also want to work at, figure out our own way and invent it from scratch at the same time. So I think it just can be this real big minefield. And the thing that's helped me the most in the whole thing is just having a tribe of other entrepreneurs around me who I can talk to about this stuff and who get it. And before I had that, I think I felt really lost with just all of it because it doesn't necessarily make sense to anyone else. And other people will give you the advice and won't realize what you're optimizing for. And I don't think I realized what I was optimizing for at first. So I'd say if I was going to leave listeners with anything, it would be find your tribe, no matter how you do it. At all costs, just do that.
I love that. And I think two things, yeah, stand out to me from our conversation, whether it's about, you know, new ways of working and leading and the inspiration we take and, you know, the examples that we draw upon is like one, you know, do these people have the same goals as you, as myself? You know, does their story or advice make sense in the context of what I'm building? And then secondly, does it make sense within the context of the step or stage I'm in with my company? And I think that is where well-meant intentions often go wrong because they do not align with our actual goal and they do not align with our stage. And then that is where the friction comes from. And so I think learning to be more discerning or learning to be more aware that that is going on has been my biggest learning in this conversation with you today.
And also, I think when other people ask for advice, I've started trying to not give them it and actually say, what do you want to achieve here? And throwing it back to them and getting a proper idea of that first before suggesting anything, because I want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. And just all you need to do is ask someone what they want to achieve, and they might work it out completely by themselves without even needing you to tell them, because all they needed was that reframing question.
Love that. But yeah, because I think that is also an easy trap, is like assuming that what worked for me will work for you and being very fast with an advice that's not appropriate for someone else. I appreciate that. Where can people find your book and how can they follow you online?
So the book is at 10yearcareer.com. Everything about me is at jodiecook.com. So jodiecook.com. And there's a contact form on there. It's linked to my Instagram. It's linked to my Twitter. And I would love anyone listening to say hey.
I highly recommend for everyone to check out your content or follow your newsletter and the things that you put out. And I'm always very inspired. And so appreciate your time today.
Amazing. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.